Well, I first would like to thank Robert Brenner for inviting me here. It's really a pleasure to be here, especially given the weather conditions in Washington, D.C. And I'm actually really delighted to be here with Anwar and Jeff, who are sort of colleagues of mine for a long time. And I really congratulate the center on its choice of topic. People are struggling to understand the economy, what's happened, and what's going on. And I think it's very, very important that they do understand, because in my view at least, it's only through understanding that we're going to change things. So today I want to tell a story about the economy. It's going to have a lot of resonances with what Anwar has just said, about how we got into the mess we are in and how we can get out of it. I think it's a story you will all understand. It's very logical. I think it's plausible, and I think it's supported by the evidence. Unfortunately, it's not the type of story that you'll hear in an economics department. It simply cannot be told in today's economics department. I'm going to borrow a line from Gordon Gekko here. Three simple words about how you can understand this crisis. Buy my book. I said buy, not read. It's coming out, and it'll be coming out to Cambridge University Press book, The Tragedy of Bad Ideas, the Great Recession, and Coming Long Stagnation. I'm a little more pessimistic than Anwar here. He thinks that they can repeat a sort of Thatcherite-Reagan recovery. I don't think they can. So it's widely agreed that the current crisis is tied to the bursting of the housing price bubble and the debt accumulated in financing the bubble. And as a result of that, a lot of commentary has focused on market failure in housing and market failure in financial markets. But I want to start with the question, what if we needed a bubble to ensure growth and full employment? In that case, the deep cause of the crisis would be the macroeconomic structure of our economy, and a focus on market failure, which is where our media tends to go, where our policymakers tend to go, would completely miss that. I'm going to argue that the roots of the crisis are a flawed U.S. macroeconomic paradigm that was adopted around 1980. And again, if you want to look back here, I did write a book in 1998 called Plenty of Nothing, which sort of described this phenomenon. And the last chapter was actually called Recipe for a Depression. I think I got it right. I think this is exactly what we could. No one can predict when these things happen. But if you're a good economist, you can identify the trends that are in play. That's really all that economists can do. And I'm going to argue that the paradigm was flawed in two dimensions. There's an underlying flawed growth model, and there's an underlying flawed model of global economic engagement. And in fact, the forces that have resulted in the crisis have been brewing for many years, and they contributed to an increasingly fragile and unstable environment. And you saw that in repeated crises, beginning sort of way back in 1987, you think of the stock market bust then. Then there was the savings and loan bust and the property bust of the early 1990s. Then again, there was the Mexican peso crisis. There was the East Asian crisis. There was the long-term capital management Russian crisis. You saw a whole series of crises repeating themselves. But policymakers just were not interested in believing that there was anything systemically wrong. It was always what today now is being called, the fashionable word, I guess, is a black swan. Some kind of surprise arrives from nowhere. Anyway, the evidence has been quite obvious, but we chose to overlook it because society got caught up in an unstable exuberance. And I really do mean society. It's not just investors. Policymakers get caught up in it as well. Politicians get caught up. We all get caught up in this phenomenon. It's a sociological phenomenon. Anyway, the winners under the paradigm did not want to change then, and they still do not want to change now, and that, of course, is part of the political problem. And from my point of view, the danger now is not that we're going to have another bigger bust. There's a lot of talk of having another financial crash. I don't think that's in the cards. I actually think we're in for a very long stagnation. And how to get out of that is part of the policy problem. So, the blow-up of the subprime market in August 2007 should be viewed as the detonator that triggered the crisis. Then you had a policy failures, like the failure to prevent the collapse of Lehman Brothers, then worsened it. But the real bedrock of the crisis is the flawed macroeconomic paradigm that the U.S. has pursued. And the roots of that paradigm trace back to the late 1970s and the early 1980s, which saw the triumph of what we term neoliberal economics. At that time, we put in place a new growth model that created a new business cycle. The old post-World War II growth model was based on two things: full employment, and second, a system in which wages were tied to productivity growth. And that created a virtuous circle that is illustrated here. The economic logic was very simple and very compelling. With wage growth tied to productivity growth, that meant robust aggregate demand through consumer spending. That in turn contributed to a situation of full employment that then provided an incentive to invest. Investment then raised productivity growth, and higher productivity growth in turn fueled wage growth. After 1980, we created a new growth model. It was marked by two features. One, a retreat from a commitment to full employment, and two, a severing of the link between productivity growth and wages. And instead of in place of the virtuous circle growth of the post-World War II growth model, we put in place a new growth model that was based essentially on debt and asset price inflation. So borrowing, the addition to debt that is, and rising asset prices became the engine of aggregate demand growth in place of wages. So the foundation of this new model were financial boom and cheap imports. Financial boom provided consumers and firms with the collateral to support debt finance spending. The borrowing was also supported by financial innovation and financial deregulation that ensured a flow of new financial products that allowed increasing leverage, allowed new groups to have access to credit, widened the range of assets that can be collateralized. I mean, it would take a whole talk to run through. It was extraordinarily wide and continuous, this stream of innovations, including, I must say here, deregulation, of course, fits into this. It's part of the story. On the other side, cheap imports ameliorated the impacts of wage stagnation, widening inequality, and increased economic insecurity. So in a way here, cheap imports play a very important role of keeping in place the political support for this new system. And you see, these features are visible. Why we really can talk about a new growth model is that its features are visible in all the business cycles after 1980. They're present in the business cycles I'm going to show with some evidence now. They're present in the business cycle of Ronald Reagan. They're present in President Clinton's business cycle. They're present in Bush 1 business cycle. They're present in Bush 2 business cycle. There are these common features, which, by the way, says something very important politically. This has been a bipartisan project. If we focus on Republicans, says that the Democrats are the good guys, we miss something very important politically, and that's, again, part of what I'm going to talk about at the end as I try and make this talk politically relevant to today. So the first thing we see is a tremendous change in patterns of manufacturing employment growth. This shows focus on the last two columns of this slide here. You see employment growth in employment in manufacturing from 1945 to 1980, and you follow it if you do it, the last two columns from the end, is you see how employment is rising every business cycle. At the peak, manufacturing employment is higher, except for 1958, which is the 50s were a bit confused because of the Korean War. You brought forward some of the employment growth, and then you lost it, then you recaptured it. So each period, at least in the business cycle, you've got kind of climbing up the mountain, getting a higher peak every time, and there's positive employment growth. After 1980, you see the reverse. You see how employment in the two columns from the right, is it the right? Yes, here. No, this here. Every peak, you're coming down the mountain, as it were. Every business cycle, you never recover the previous peak level of manufacturing employment. And then rather shockingly, in the last two business cycles, not only don't you recover the previous peak level of manufacturing employment, you actually have manufacturing loss of manufacturing employment during the boom, which is a complete break with the pattern of American history. You also see a change in the trade deficit. From basically 1960 through to around 1980, we started with a small surplus. We then turned to a small trade deficit in the 70s, but we essentially ran roughly balanced trade. And that is because if you talk to policymakers, they were aware of the trade deficit as a potential problem because it was a leakage of spending, a leakage of demand out of the economy that could undermine this virtuous circle. After 1980, the situation changes and you get massively rising trade deficits, which become an ever larger portion of GDP. And in 2007, the peak of the last business cycle, the trade deficit was 5.9% of GDP. And you see this not just in the numbers, you see it in a change policy rhetoric as well. Now, in fact, policymakers like Alan Greenspan talk of the trade deficit almost as if it's semi-virtuous. Why? Because it helps them contain inflation. And then they also have an ideology here that the choices that are being made in the market reflect the decisions of consenting adults, and those choices are good for the economy. That's why they rationalize this and why they can be blind to what's going on. The new model is also very evident in the patterns of income distribution and income inequality, and this is from the same slide that Anwar showed a little earlier, but just from 1959 rather than going back in history. The bottom line, the pink line, is real wages, an index of real wages, and the black line is an index of productivity. And you see how through to roughly the mid-1970s, productivity and real wages are roughly tracking each other. Some separation is beginning to emerge, but after the late 70s, 79, 80, productivity continues going upwards, similar pace as before, but real wages flatline. You see it also in the distribution of family income. We see that, in fact, from 1947 to 1979, the bottom 40% increased, 40% of households here increased their share of the income distribution. The top 5% actually lost in terms of share. Same, the next 15% had a slight small increase. After 1979, the pattern completely reverses. You can think of 1947 to 1977 as a case of the U.S. economy growing together. From 1979 onward, it's a case of us growing apart. So you see the bottom 40% losing their share of the pie, as it were, is shrinking, and the top 20%, their share is growing enormously. Tremendous rapid growth in the top 5%, and if you were to look at the top 1%, it's even sharper. It turns out that really a huge amount of the gains, the lion's share, are actually accumulating to the top 1%. And of course, all of these trends in income distribution are really captured in this figure about CEO pay. The ratio of CEO pay, it's the picture that says it all. The picture is worth 1,000 words, as it were. In 1979, the average CEO was paid 38 times average worker pay. In 2000, it was 300 times average worker pay. 2005, it was 262 times worker pay. Anyway, economic policy played a critical role in generating and shaping this new growth model. We installed a new neoliberal paradigm. The essence of this paradigm is to weaken the position of workers, strengthen the position of corporations, and uncuff financial markets to serve the interests of financial and business elites. And the new paradigm can be described what I call a neoliberal box. The basic idea is that a box, you put workers inside, and then you box them in on all sides by policy. And the four pieces of policy I'm going to focus on the left-hand side is... everything is reversed from the screen. globalization, which of course is the policies of free trade, capital mobility. In the developing world, it's the policies of the Washington Consensus that are put in place by the IMF and the World Bank. That's why those institutions are so important, because when they put these policies in place, it globally multiplies the impact. So you're getting all countries are being pushed to engage in deregulatory competition, deregulate within and compete across sort of deregulatory competition in finance, in labor markets, in corporate governance, across the board. And so you get wage stagnation everywhere, in north and south. And this contributes to the emergence of global demand shortage and conditions of deflation. On the other side, opposing globalization, you have small government. This is the agenda of the Chicago School, Milton Friedman, the Night Watchman State. You have an attack on the legitimacy of government activity, and you persistently push for deregulation regardless of any dangers. From the bottom, you have this familiar labor market flexibility agenda. Here you get an attack on unions, attack on labor market supports like the minimum wage, unemployment benefits, employment protections, employee rights. And by the way, again, all of these things you'll recognize were going on in all administrations. The Clinton administration, of course, welfare reform was really the fundamental attack here, in a sense, on the labor market flexibility, the taking away of the right to welfare that the New Deal had conferred. And then you get the abandonment of full employment. This comes through in the new rhetoric of inflation targeting. And you get a turning over of the management of central banks and monetary policy to what are called independent central banks. So policy really is critical in destroying the earlier virtuous circle model. And I want to just say that really this is something that's important to understand. I've always been very critical of the trade unions for not taking this stuff seriously enough. Because if you're a union, you cannot outrun this. No matter how good you are at organizing, if you organize one factory, they will close it down. If you're in the public sector, they're going to come after you with the small government agenda. And all workers, no matter where they work, are under attack from the abandonment of full employment and labor market flexibility. You cannot solve this problem without going to the roots of policy. And if you want to win the policy debate, you have to go to the roots of economics. And that's why in my book it's a lot about this, about behind this stuff is ideas. And that's the only way that you're going to get beyond it. Let me talk about here the role of finance, how we kind of can connect the dots a bit. We replaced this virtuous circle growth model with a new model based on debt and asset price inflation and lower saving rates of households. And this is where finance enters the picture, because finance fills the demand gap that is created by the new growth model. And so you see how, I love this slide actually. I took it from a newsletter that came into my hands from Jeremy Grantham, who's a major hedge fund manager. He even understands it a little bit. Here you have a story of sort of GDP growth, the trend line and the growth around it, and it's divided in about 1979-1980. What he calls the stable debt era, what I'm calling the Keynesian era, and the rising debt era, which is the neoliberal era. And you see that, in fact, GDP growth actually slows down after 1980. It doesn't accelerate. You get a slowing down of GDP growth. But look at the bottom line, and the bottom line, the total debt line. You see, between 1952 and 1979, we had roughly stable debt to GDP, 150% roundabout. Then it just explodes, and debt goes, this is total debt here, debt of household sector, corporate sector, business sector, and government. You get an explosion in debt relative to GDP. It happens everywhere. So everyone is leveraging up to fill this demand gap that the new model produces. And you see it here. This is the household sector here. Look at the H to GDP. That's household debt relative to GDP. In 1960, 41% of GDP. By 2007, it's 100% of GDP. If you look at the corporate, this is the corporate sector, the non-financial business sector. 1960, 38%, their debt is 38% of GDP. By 2007, 77% of GDP. This is household debt service. This is what Anwar was talking about before, what you have to pay on your credit card to stay current, as it were. The debt service ratio rises from 10.9% of disposable income in Q3 1980 to 14.3% in Q4 2007. And remember, this is taking place against the background of falling interest rates. In 1980, interest rates were close to 20%. By 2007, they're around 4%. So you have a rise in interest service even though the interest rate is coming down, which shows how much underlying borrowing was taking place. This is an interesting piece about house price inflation. I've got home price inflation, the first line, then average CPI inflation, second line, and then excess house price house price inflation, which is when you subtract CPI inflation from home price inflation. Now, the Case-Shiller index is an index of house prices only available from first quarter 1981. But what I've divided into four sub-periods here, and what you basically see is that the economy only grows when house price inflation exceeds CPI inflation. That then gives you an asset that turns your house into an ATM, you can borrow against it, start consuming, and that gets employment going. And the rather important thing here also is look at the quarter 1995 to 2001. Everyone talks about the house price bubble as if it began in the Bush administration. It actually began in the Clinton administration. And a big part of the success of the apparent success, or so-called success of the 1990s, was that we had house price inflation that fueled the recovery, along with other things, including the stock market bubble. Another thing here, you see the personal saving rate. We're really trying to have to go to every source of demand that we can. The personal saving rate from 1960 to 1980 actually rises slightly, 7.3% to 10%. Then after 1980, we get a steady decline in the personal saving rate, hitting in 2007, just 0.6% of GDP. And of course, so there's nowhere to go anymore. And in fact, that's part of the problem, that people are actually starting to save a little bit more. So saving behavior is moving in the wrong direction for a recovery. So the problem with this new growth model is it's intrinsically unsustainable. How long do I have left?
You have about
Great. Okay. The problem is this growth model is intrinsically unstable. It's unsustainable and unstable. It's squeezing the income of workers. It's squeezing household saving rates. It's raising debt levels. It's pushing asset price inflation. And all of these processes must end in tears. You eventually hit a debt ceiling. You eventually push the saving rate to zero, or you create an asset price bubble that then implodes on you. And the process, but the problem here, and this is what's been so difficult for, I think, all of us economists here at this table, is the process lasted just far, far longer than any of us believed possible. Because they were able to push up debt limits to levels that had not been seen in the history of the American economy. You were able to squeeze the saving rates to lows that had not been seen before. And you were able to push up asset prices into unpredictable highs. And that, in a sense, is the real significance of financial innovation and financial deregulation. Because they allowed those limits to keep coming off and therefore keep the process going. But once you see it in that way, then you realize that finance didn't really cause the crisis. It just kept the model going longer than it would have happened otherwise. On the other hand, that did mean that when the system eventually reached its limits, it essentially collapsed because of the huge amounts of unsupportable debt that had been accumulated. Now, this then gets to the international piece of it. This model might have gone on much, much longer, but for the flawed model of global economic engagement. Because essentially, our model of global economic engagement created a triple hemorrhage. We had a leaking of spending out of the economy via imports. We had a leakage of jobs out of the economy by offshore outsourcing and shifting of production. And we had a leakage of investment spending out of the economy via offshoring. And this triple hemorrhage accelerated the contradictions in the neoliberal model by further undercutting income and employment. And the root of this triple hemorrhage is our model of international economic policy that broke the old model of trade. Instead of running roughly balanced trade, we've run huge trade deficits. And instead of creating a global marketplace in which U.S. firms could export, we created a global production zone from which American firms could export to the U.S. and from which they could buy cheaper imports. And there are three critical stages in this new model. Stage one was NAFTA. Stage two was the strong dollar policy that was put in place after the East Asia financial crisis of 1997. And stage three was China PNTR in 2000. All of these measures were implemented, by the way, again, under President Clinton, under the advice of Treasury Secretaries Summers and Rubin. It was they who cemented the globalization model that had been lobbied for by corporations and Washington policy think tanks. The irony is that when corporations got what they wanted, the result was to undermine the neoliberal model at warp speed. So we have to start then first with NAFTA, which basically fused the U.S., Canada, and Mexico into a unified production zone. And what's so new and important about NAFTA, for the very first time, we join a developed and developing economy together. So we essentially create the template for globalization that we now have. It also changed the significance of exchange rates. Previously, exchange rates only mattered for trade, but now they matter for the location of production and investment. And it changed, very importantly, some politics. It changed the attitude of corporations to the exchange rates. They now become in favor of a strong dollar because it lowers the price of imported goods and it increases the profit margins on their foreign production. Before, corporations would have been against the strong dollar. Now they become for it. And finally, a last thing about NAFTA is it created the precedent for the strong dollar policy that was put in place in 1997, because once NAFTA occurred, there was immediately a peso crisis, and part of the solution to the problem was to accept the devaluation of the peso and therefore make the dollar strong against the Mexican currency. And NAFTA results are very clear. The first thing that we see here is the trade deficit with Mexico. Before NAFTA, we're actually running a small surplus. After NAFTA, we then start to run a progressively growing deficit. We see closure of manufacturing plants, shifting of production and investment to Mexico, and we also see, very importantly, very well documented by Kate Bronfenbrenner, who's a labor economist at Cornell, we see the use of the threat of shifting jobs to Mexico as a way to suppress and batter unions. I'm running short of time, so I'm going to run through, just try and confirm this. The East Asian financial policy comes, the East Asian financial crisis and the strong dollar policy comes after that. The way out of this crisis is to let the currencies of our East Asian trading partners depreciate, and therefore makes increases the competitive position of East Asia. And we see a very familiar pattern. This is the U.S. good trade balance. It's large before 1997, but after 1997, it then explodes. And it doesn't not just globally, but here's the situation with the Pacific Rim countries. After 1997, a major break and an explosion in the deficit with the East Asia countries. Then the final thing is China PNTR. We had NAFTA, we had the disastrous strong dollar policy response to the East Asia crisis, but despite that, business was able to push through this very, very important last stage. They pushed through China PNTR when they give China permanent normal trading rights in the U.S., which in turn opens up access to the WTO for China. Now, the problem is, why were they able to do this? The effects of the globalization policy that was being put in place took time to fully emerge. And more than that, in the 1990s, the effects of these trade policies was being obscured and covered up by what was going on in our domestic economy. So when you began to have a housing price boom with borrowing off your housing, when you began to have a stock market boom, and then when you had the internet bubble on top of that, that obscured the negative effects of this flawed global economic engagement. And because of that, business was able to push through the last stage of this globalization model. And that that in turn sort of cemented the structure of globalization that corporations had wanted. This China really is the big enchilada because it makes China part of this global production zone. Anyway, you see it here. This is the China trade balance, and a lot more details in the paper. By the way, if you want to read this paper, it's available on the New America Foundation website. Here's the China trade deficit. We're running a growing trade deficit. 2001, it's $83 billion. But after 2001, you get an explosion in the trade deficit, $256 billion in 2007. China now accounts for something like 80% of our overall non-oil trade deficit. So you can then kind of, the chickens come home to roost, as it were, in the last 5 years. We created a growth model that needed bubbles. That's the important thing to realize. We needed bubbles to keep the thing going. The weaker the economy became, the larger the bubbles it needed. And the flawed global model of global engagement devastated the economy and accelerated its weakening in this last in the period of the Bush-Cheney administration. That's why we had essentially no a jobless recovery that ran from 2001 through to 2004. That in turn meant We needed another bubble, and the only thing that could provide that bubble of sufficient magnitude was housing. So after 2001, the economy gets stuck in an extended jobless recovery, despite very aggressive monetary and fiscal policy. The fear that we're about to slip back into recession, go back and read the newspapers if you want at that period, it's that fear that pushes the Federal Reserve to lower interest rates to 1% and hold them there for an extended period of time. Right wing wants to blame the Fed. In some ways, the Fed was doing what was very sensible monetary policy. Not saying the Fed should be off the hook. In fact, far from it. Alan Greenspan does not understand what's going on. He supports an ideology that's highly destructive of the prosperity we have. But in terms of the formal setting of monetary policy, if I'd been chairman of the Federal Reserve, I would have done it too. Okay. Where next? Let me just have something about the ultimate cause of the crisis is the flawed U.S. macroeconomic paradigm. That paradigm needs bubbles if the economy is to grow. Financial deregulation in excess facilitated the bubble, but they're really part of the neoliberal paradigm. This is very important because actually fixing regulation and fixing the microeconomic incentive problems that we have on Wall Street will stabilize the system by limiting financial excess, but it does nothing to address the underlying macroeconomic issues that I've been talking about, the problem of the growth model and the problem of international engagement. And in fact, worse than that, it could actually lower growth because it's removing one of the few engines of growth that this unstable neoliberal model has. So we need to change the paradigm, but as yet, there is no recognition of need for change. In fact, far from it. The Obama administration is committed to maintaining the system rather than to changing it, and that's my objection to the Obama administration as a progressive Democrat. They don't believe that anything is fundamentally wrong with the paradigm. They sort of believe, I think, that they can jumpstart the economy and it will go back to the way it was. That's not going to happen. Instead, the economy will stabilize, but it will be unable to escape the pull of stagnation because the neoliberal model is burnt out, and stagnation is therefore the next logical step. What's needed? Well, I like to talk about repacking the box. If the neoliberal policy box is the problem, we need to take workers out of the box and put corporations and financial markets inside it. So that means a remaking of globalization, what we might call a managed globalization. With regard to government, a social democratic government. With regard to labor markets, get rid of the labor market flexibility agenda. We have to be talking about some sort of solidaristic labor markets, a solidarity agenda. And of course, back to the commitment to full employment. I would say that, by the way, a little deeper, if you think of a box, four sides is actually an unstable box. A stable box has six sides. So where's the power behind this box? If that's the policies, the power is, of course, financial markets and corporations. And that's how we need to think of a control agenda here. Making financial markets serve people, taking out the political power they have. Making the corporations be engines of prosperity, which is what they were originally set up for in terms of U.S. law. The political problem? Well, I'm going to separate ideas. Neoliberalism is the dominant ideology, and that is what we have to take down. There's sort of two points of view here. One is the concept is sound, the other is the concept is problematic. People who think it's problematic, like myself, I call us labor social democrats. But there are others who think the concept is sound, and here you have to divide, and this is how it's so hard to pull this debate about in public. You've got hardcore neoliberals. That's the guys coming out of Chicago, coming out of Minnesota. But you have the softcore neoliberals coming out of MIT and coming out of Princeton. They're the third-way social democrats, and this puts up as a false debate. It's like I like to call it, the choice we're being offered is a choice between Coke and Pepsi. That's not a choice. Somehow, we have to crack this thing open and get labor social democrats into the mix. Here's the problem politically. The Democratic Party is essentially captured. It's captured by the money of Wall Street, and it's captured by the ideas of softcore neoliberalism. That's the dominant party. That's the Obama administration, if you want to understand what it's about. Wall Street money, softcore neoliberal ideas. What I think is my populist voice here, well, we need, obviously, Main Street to be back in charge of the Democrats as they once were, combined with a philosophy or economic set of ideas that I call structural Keynesianism. Thanks very much.
All right.